This evening, I have the privilege of talking to you a little bit about St. Thomas Aquinas on love, body, and soul. As Father said, St. Thomas is one of our great geniuses in the Catholic Church, in the Western Church, and in the Dominican Order. His thought is paralleled by none, and certainly in the Dominican opinion. You probably are most familiar with his work, the Summa Theologiae, which in the English edition is about four volumes. In that work, he asks over 3,100 questions, and he answers all 3,118. I think it's 3,118 questions. He answers them. They're often questions no one thought to ask in the 13th century. And then he answers any objections that you might have to his answer. So this is how his mind worked. It's said that at the end of his life, he was writing four or five things at one time, without word processors, without a printing press, often with multiple scribes, which he would just go down the row, dictating a paragraph to this scribe. If maybe it's the commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, maybe it's the next part of the Summa Theologiae, maybe it's a commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. And by the time he got back to the first one, he'd know exactly where that paragraph left off, and he would dictate the next paragraph. So his mind was working on multiple tracks at all times, right? The only parallel, the modern parallel that I can think of is someone like the genius Bobby Fischer. If you know who the chess master Bobby Fischer is, they say that he could play multiple chess games at one time. This is how St. Thomas did theology, right? The way Bobby Fischer did chess. This evening, just to give you a little outline of where we're going, we're going to talk about basically four things on the body, the soul, and love. We're going to first talk about avoiding dualism. I want to focus on the human composite, what St. Thomas calls the human composite, which is that we are body and soul. This is to distinguish that we're not just body and not just the soul. We're going to talk about the morality of passion, or the moralities of passions, as you might say. We'll talk about the good and what love is for St. Thomas. And then finally, we're going to conclude with happiness and virtue. So these four things, I hope, in 45 minutes. All right? I always like to remind people that with St. Thomas, whenever you do something like this in 45 minutes, just to know that pretty much every one of these things would be weeks. Like if you were at the Dominican House of Studies studying for a master's in theology, these would be weeks, each of these four bullet points. So we're just sort of skipping stones across the surface of the thought of St. Thomas. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, where we stand. Just with our culture, it's very easy to focus on the human person only on the material, only on, say, neuroscience or brain scans. It's very easy to focus only on how the body looks or how the body feels. On the other hand, it's also very easy to focus perhaps only on the transcendental, only on spiritual meditation. This phrase that beauty is skin deep. St. Thomas would not necessarily disagree with that, but he would say that there's more to it, that your skin and your body is very much a part of your beauty, very much a part of your person. Yes, true, beauty is more than just what is on the outside, but the outside is not to be diminished or devalued. In fact, I think St. Thomas might argue that in today's culture, it's not that the body is treated so well, it's that we're not treating the body well enough. We're not reverencing the body well enough in our contemporary culture. That's generally because we have fallen, in St. Thomas's view, I would argue, we have fallen to an essential dualism, especially after in a post-Cartesian world, after you have someone like René Descartes and modernity, who suggest that the body and soul are different things, different components of the person. This is not new. This is not simply a modern problem. This is a problem that even Plato had. Plato generally saw the soul as the motor of the body, right? If any of you have read Plato's Republic or the Timaeus, you know, Plato sort of saw the soul as this eternal form that gets thrown into the body, is entrapped in the body, and is just looking to escape from the body. So the soul is weighed down by the body. René Descartes sees the soul as the captain of the machine, the ghost of the machine. The old heresy of Gnosticism, which is an old heresy of Christianity that was there from the beginning, recurs century after century in different forms. In the 13th century, it took the form of a certain Albigensianism. In Augustine's time, it was Manichaeism, but the idea that the soul is divine and the body is evil. Even in the way you read the New Testament, there are passages in the letters of St. Paul that can suggest this, that can lead you to think the body is sort of this this penance that you have to endure, that you need to shed this mortal coil to become your true self. St. Thomas would dismiss any such idea with absolute prejudice. He would dismiss it. We are neither just the soul nor just the body. We are both body and soul. When he speaks about the human person, he uses the word compositum humanum, which means a human composite. We are a composite of body and soul. He's building here, of course, off the philosophy of Aristotle, a student of Plato. For Aristotle, the biggest distinction in the created order in the world is the distinction between matter and form. This is just a very brief philosophy 101 slide here. Matter, when you think of matter, think of the stuff of things, the stuff a chair is made of, the stuff the statue David is made of, the marble. Another way St. Thomas thinks about it is it's pure potency, it's potential. The marble can become anything. The stuff of wood can become, it's got the potency to become anything. I can put any sort of shape to it that I want. Right? Another way to think about matter is that it's the concrete instantiation, this stuff right here, and putting it together. Now, how it's put together is the form for Aristotle. That which gives matter shape and function. You follow me so far? So it's what makes Michelangelo's David, David. Right? The matter is the marble. The form is this wonderful male figure. Another way to think about the form is that it contains and defines the matter. You never see just matter walking down the street. You see a dog walking down the street. You see a person walking down the street. You see a tree that's planted. There's no such thing as pure matter in the Aristotelian Thomistic position, right? There's no such thing. It always has a form to it, a definite shape. And if it has a definite shape, a definite form, it also has a definite function. It has a definite, I mean, to use some faith language, it has a definite purpose. It has a definite goal, a telos, to use Aristotle's language. So, the matter is the marble, the form is David. The purpose of the form, you can talk about art, you can talk about beauty in this particular instance, but whether you're talking about David, or since it's evening and some of us haven't had dinner yet, you can talk about the matter of a pizza and the perfect form of a pizza. You might have arguments about what makes a pizza perfect and what sort of toppings properly belong to the form of a pizza and what toppings should never be put on a pizza, like pineapples, right? Okay. So that pineapples do not belong properly to the form of pizza, that they're accidental to a pizza. They're incidental to a pizza. The same is true for St. Thomas when it comes to the human person, to the human composite. We have matter. We have stuff. Now, just to be simplistic about it, and you can scientifically work your way down this, we're just going to say, just for ease tonight, the matter is the flesh. It's the body. Now, that's true all the way down. That's true for not just my flesh, that's everything in my body. All my tissues, all my systems, all my cells, all my molecules, all my atoms. And each of those have their own sort of form and how it works together. But it's the matter, it's the body, it's the stuff of me, okay? The form for St. Thomas is not simply Thomas Petrie, that I look like a human. This is very important that you understand this. For both Aristotle and for St. Thomas Aquinas, while you can think of a general form of what it means to be a human, you know, two eyes, two ears, two arms, two legs, by which you can then measure, you know, when someone suffers a certain defect, born without an arm, so, you know, they don't quite match up to the form there. They're still human, but there clearly is something that's not there that should be there. There is a general definition, certainly, of form, but there's also concrete, particular forms. Just as, while there's a general definition of what a chair is, there's the form of this particular chair. For St. Thomas, the form of the human person, what makes this body do what it's supposed to do as a whole, as an organism, we might say, is the form. It's what he calls, it's the rational soul. In Latin, soul is anima. It means, it's where we get the word animate. The soul is the principle of life. It's what makes the whole flesh molecules, cells, systems, the whole structure organized and coordinated. You might say to me, well, but we know that there are certain glands and proteins that are operating. St. Thomas would say, yes, yes, that's all true, but that's all on the material, fleshly level. That there is, in fact, a form. And this is what makes my body a living body, animates my body. It's what's the difference between this living body of mine and a cadaver and a corpse, which is no longer properly organized. When a body dies, when a person dies, the body, the systems are no longer working together in an organized fashion. Right? So the soul is the principle. One way to think about this, if you're thinking about it scientifically, is yes, we can look at proteins that affect various DNA and affect, you know, epigenetic signatures and what cells do this and when they divide and how they divide. St. Thomas would say the catalyst or the power, the energy, if you will, that's behind all of that is what we call the soul. That's what he would say, as a whole. And the soul is what sort of is the thread that keeps the body completely organized from its beginning until its death. The human person is therefore, for St. Thomas, not simply the soul, but soul and body. The human person is a composite being. Now, there's a difficulty in translating some of this and dialoguing between Aristotelian and Thomas with modern scientists. So simply to say that, in my view, there's nothing about the human person or the human organism that science has yet to discover that St. Thomas would be surprised by. And we'll see a little bit more of that as we go forward. Okay? There's nothing he would be surprised by. He sees the soul as the principle of organization, the animating principle, the principle of life that keeps everything in continuity. So the form is the principle of continuity. It's what guarantees coherence and unity in the material as the material changes. Aristotle has a thing he calls substantial change. A substantial change is when the form is no longer there. So when a tree catches fire and it burns down, it would be stupid to call the pile of ash in front of you a tree anymore. It's no longer the form of tree. The matter, you can still trace the continuity of the matter. You can look at those atoms and say, oh, these atoms, these were all part of the tree at one point. But the form is not there. It would be irreconcilable. It's just a pile of ashes. He says the same thing is true of a corpse and a living body. You can say it's the same atoms there, but it's no longer in continuity with what came before because it's no longer organized. Now, this is clear. For St. Thomas, matter, the only reason there is matter is for the sake of being formed in some way. As I said, you never see matter just walking down the street by itself. It's always informed. It's always in some sort of form. And the form determines why the matter is the way it is. The form of David in that marble, put there by the sculptor, determines why that marble is sitting in that museum the way that it is, so that you can appreciate it in the form of David. This means the Summa Theologiae, the first part, question 76, article 5. I didn't put quotes on all or citations on all of these. And as I said, the soul is the principle. It's the energy of life. So, it's the soul that takes the matter of the baby, and as the baby grows, the soul does not change, even if the matter changes. So I'm talking to, I'm sure, scientists here. What's the number of years, like if we look at it in the long haul, where we know that all of your cells kind of turn over, like 10 years, 8 years, 10 years, is that right? You all know what I'm talking about? Seven? Something like that. You know what I'm talking about? Like all, it's the soul that guarantees that you're not a different person 7 years from now. That guarantees the continuity of the matter, so that the baby is the same person as the adult. All right. Now, the human composite, for St. Thomas, the intellectual soul, which is what we have, let me just do a little footnote here. For St. Thomas, all living things have souls, whether we're talking plants, cats, dogs, or persons. All living things have souls. There's a difference in the types of souls, which we can get into some other time, our souls he calls rational or intellectual souls. And he's going to argue, because he's a man of faith, that the intellectual soul, your soul and mine, is united by its very being, which is to say, its very existence to the body. For the Christian, the soul is not to be considered trapped in the body. The soul is made to be in the body by its very existence. We are not pure spirits like angels that are enslaved in the body. The soul needs the body, in fact, for St. Thomas, and I would say for all of the Christian tradition, for Scripture, the soul needs the body. This is why I can just say this. It's absolutely false, and I know it's cute, and there's all sorts of Hallmark cards that will say this, that when we die, we become angels. That is absolutely false from a Christian tradition. Absolutely false. Right? We are souls that are created by a very being to be with a body. Not just any body. Your particular body is what your soul is meant to be in. The soul needs the body for knowledge, for movement. John Paul II sort of modified some of St. Thomas and likes to say that the body communicates the person or communicates the soul. It manifests the soul. If it weren't for the body, St. Thomas would argue, you would not be able to know anything. You would not be able to communicate. You would not be able to manifest. Your soul would be helpless without your body. Because that's the way God created your soul to be. Now, what's his basic proof of this? The resurrection of the dead. The central Christian tenet of faith. The very fact that we believe at the end of time that all bodies will rise means that the body is important. And there's something about your soul that needs to be with the body. For Aquinas, this begins even in this life. The soul, all knowledge for St. Thomas begins with the senses. Seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, and smelling. For St. Thomas, that's all the body. We take in data. We take in data with our senses. But then there are interior senses for St. Thomas. And some people who study brain science and neurology can sort of see how much some of this might work. For St. Thomas, this has all sorts of implications, which I can't get into. Wonderful implications for St. Thomas. The imagination, part of the body, not part of the soul. Memory, it's part of the body, not of the soul. The common sense, by common sense, he doesn't mean, you know, when you say to somebody, he ain't got no common sense. That's not what he means here. The common sense for St. Thomas is a bodily sense, we might say it's whatever happens in the brain, that is able to unite the information of the five external senses. So that I can know that how this gray chair feels with my sense of touch, but my sense of touch doesn't know it's gray. My sense of sight does. The common sense puts that together, so I know that this is how this gray thing feels. Okay, that's the common. That's all in the body for St. Thomas. And the estimative or cognitive, which I'm not going to get too much into, is a sort of an instinct, a natural biological instincts that we can have about certain, you know, it's like the fight, what we might call fight or flight now. That's all biology. All of this is in the body for St. Thomas. Side note, for St. Thomas, dogs have all of this. Not necessarily plants, but dogs have all of this. Dogs have imagination, Aristotle too. Dogs have memory. You ever see a dog running in its dreams? You see its little paws moving? Dogs have memories. They have imaginations. They don't have rational thought, but they do have memories and imagination, right? That they can't necessarily control. But let me just say this one more thing on this. Even the most abstract concept for Aristotle and for Thomas, whether it's love, freedom, or God, are using these bodily senses to think about. So when I ask you to think about freedom, you're using your imagination, your memory to think about free experiences. Maybe there's a thought in your mind, the American flag, whatever it is. You're always using, the brain is always working with images that the soul is using to, in fact, transcend the material. This is where St. Thomas's thought, Aristotle's thought, is going to butt up against a hardened materialist science. Aquinas will argue that there are some rational thoughts that, though they begin in the body and begin in the senses, transcend the body. And this is knowledge, what we might call universal knowledge or abstract knowledge, which is to say, best to compare it with a dog again. You know, my Aunt Kay has a toy poodle, Teddy, who I absolutely despise. Now, Teddy drinks out of the commode in the bathroom, which is disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. And she leaves the lid up so he can do this, which is absolutely horrible and disgusting. Now, when we take Teddy to a new house, Teddy, when he comes back home, he has memory of where the commode is. He knows where that room is. He's been in it. He's got memory. He doesn't need to be shown it. When we go into a new house that he's never been into, Teddy does not have the universal concept of homes, and that most homes actually have one of these rooms with one of these things where you can get water out of it. Right? You and I do. That's universal knowledge for St. Thomas. I don't have to be shown, oh, you have one too. I can simply assume that this house, built in since the 20th century, has a bathroom. That's universal knowledge that no material can get to. The same is true. That's a very plain, mundane thing. But the same is true for higher abstract concepts of freedom, love, truth, goodness, God, and so forth. Here's what St. Thomas says. It is natural for the soul to understand by turning to the phantasms, as it is for it to be joined to the body. But to be separated from the body is not in accordance with its nature, and likewise to understand without turning to phantasms is not natural to it. Basically, all of that sense information we get, how we use our imagination, how we use our memory, we're always phantasms. When you think of the word phantasm, just think of mental images. We always got mental images going on. When I tell you to think about God, you got some sort of mental image. I don't know, some guy in a beard and a throne of white, I don't know, right? You've got a mental image. Maybe it's the face of Jesus Christ. Right? This is why for Catholics, when we talk about spiritualities, and you know, sometimes you'll be doing some sort of spiritual experience, and the group leaders say, clear your minds. St. Thomas, a Dominican, is going to tell you that's literally impossible. It is literally impossible to have a blank mind. Someone tells you to blank your minds, what do? You think of a wall, brick wall, white wall. Sorry, that's an image. It's an image in your head. This is all St. Thomas is saying. The soul, by definition, even the most abstract concept like, you know, Pythagorean theorem. I tell you the thing about Pythagorean theorem, you start thinking about it, there's an image in your head. It might be just the letters A squared plus B squared equals C squared. It might be a right triangle, whatever it is. It's impossible to do any mental work without the brain and the imagery working. The soul cannot love, truth, freedom. Every time you're thinking about abstract images, even things that don't exist in the natural world, like unicorns, you're using your memory to put a horn on a horse, an imagination, right? For St. Thomas, this explains why some people are smarter than others. Some people just have biologically better imaginations, better memories. These are people that you know, that you're in school with, that you can't stand because they make quicker connections than you do because they just have a better imagination or a better memory of things and you have to work harder at it. St. Thomas says that's fine. They're just biologically disposed better than you are. Their bodies are better disposed. If this were not true for St. Thomas, we would be back to Gnosticism. Because then the soul would need the body for nothing. It would simply be the ghost in the machine. The body and the soul need each other. The body needs the soul as the principle of life and organization. The soul needs the body for knowledge, for communication, and for movement. Simply to say, when we talk about the hierarchy of being, the human person sort of fits in the middle of things. You know, you can start thinking about nothingness, which is not really anything. It's just down here. But inanimate matter, rocks, plants, animals, the human, the angels. In Aquinas' view, the human person is basically at the top of what we might call the material world, right? Because he has an intellectual soul. But he's also part of the spiritual world with the angels. So he's sort of the link between the two. This is going to be important a little bit later, okay? Now, where do you think God is on this? The temptation is to put God up at the top here. But the thing is, for St. Thomas, this would be a whole other lecture. God is not the supreme being. That makes it seem like he's like the super entity of this ladder. He's actually what's holding the whole ladder up. He is existence itself. He's sort of, so everything for the Christian, think about St. Paul's speech to the Areopagus in the Acts of the Apostles. I even found an altar dedicated to an unknown God. Well, it is this God that I preach, the God in whom we live and move and have our being. He's the one in whom all things exist, right? So he's not the supreme being. This is an important point to make and comes back to the relationship of the soul and the body. Because for St. Thomas, this material world actually exists within the larger existence of God, which we might call pure spirit. For St. Thomas, he's so, and it's not that he's intending to be anti-dualist, but he's so into the fact that God is the source and the ground of everything that exists and in whom all existing things are participating because he is existence itself, that for him, whereas we tend to think of the spiritual as existing separate than the material, or the soul existing within the body, for St. Thomas, it's the other way around. The body exists within the soul. The material exists within the spiritual. Back to this. Although corporeal things, physical things, are said to be in another, as in that which contains them, I put a ping pong ball into a glass. The physical corporeal ball is in the glass. Nevertheless, spiritual things contain those things in which they are, as the soul contains the body. Hence, also God is in things containing them. Nevertheless, by a certain similitude or analogy to corporeal things, it is said that all things are in God, inasmuch as they are contained in him. And then later, he says, rather does the soul contain the body and make it one. You go back to this. It's not that the marble is somehow its own thing. The marble is contained in the form of David. It's the marble that's in the form of David, not the form of David that's in the marble. You following me on this? The same is true for the human person. We look at the human body and we think, oh, and if you're a believer, you might think, well, the soul is in there somewhere. Wrong, wrong, wrong. You look at the human body and you should see, no, the body is actually in the soul. So that the body is actually a witness, the manifestation of the soul in the material world. St. Thomas is so adamant about this. 2 points. In his Theology of Angels, Pure Spirits, Angels and Demons, he insists that the angels cannot read your soul, they cannot read your heart, because that's only God can do that. But because the body is within the soul, and because the soul and the body are completely enmeshed in this one composite human person, whatever happens in the soul affects the body. So if you're sad, there's bodily, corporeal changes. You know, you might start to cry, you might blush. There's all sorts of nonverbals you give off, even when you don't want to. St. Thomas says that even though angelic creatures can't read the soul, they can read the body more perfectly than you and I can. So it's almost as if they can read your soul, because everything that happens in your soul is manifest in the body. Everything. So when you meet people, and we know people like this who are just very intuitive, like they can read you. Sometimes you'd have people close to you who know what you're thinking even before you say it, because they can see it written on your face, you know. angelic creatures for St. Thomas can do that infinitely better than the smartest, most intuitive human person. That's somewhat terrifying if you think about it too long, but that's how far he's willing to go. When he talks about the Blessed Mother and the graces at work in her soul, he's quite clear that the graces at work in her soul manifest in her body, and so therefore she had to be radiantly beautiful. She had to be radiantly beautiful. In fact, he's so strong on that that he says that this, she's so beautiful that men could not have not noticed her when she was in public. But, he says, because of the graces at work in her, they would never have coveted her or lusted after her. That she, the graces would overflow from her and quell any concupiscence in the men around her. But they, so they, all they would notice is this beautiful woman that walked in the room, and they would stop and pick up their jaws off the floor and be stunned by her beauty because of the grace at work in her soul. Right? And whenever you read about the apparitions, any of the approved apparitions, Lourdes, Fatima, Labouré, that's the first thing they all say. Right? She's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Now, let's talk a little bit about the passions of the soul. Moving right along here. Passions of the body, I'm sorry. For St. Thomas, the body, once again, just the physical side of us, has two, what he calls, appetites. The concupiscible appetite, which is an appetite that desires good things and wants to flee from bad things, evil things. We'll talk about what that means in a minute. And the irascible, which is the emotions, the physical. Think of your chemistry, your bodily chemistry, how your juices get going when you see something that you really want. That's the concupiscible for St. Thomas. The irascible is the things, the chemistry, the emotions, the passions that flare up when there's a good that's difficult that you see, that you want, but you know it's going to be hard to get it. Or that there's an evil that you don't want to experience, but you know it's going to be hard to avoid it. The irascible flares up. We're not going to spend time on all of these emotions, but he has like counterparts. So like in the concupiscible, love of the thing that I'm attracted to, hatred of the thing I want to avoid, my desire for it, that I'm going to move towards it, my juices are moving towards it, and aversion, I'm going to try to stay away from it. And then, of course, once I finally have it, the joy of having it, if the evil comes to me I really don't want, then the sort of sadness of having to endure it, right? The irascible are directly, these are the passions, the emotions that sort of trigger in when we're, you know, we really need to put the shoulder to the plow and move forward, you know. So with regard to the good, it's the hope that I can actually get this. This is not the theological virtue. This is just the emotion of being hopeful. Or despair, I am not going to avoid this, you know, whatever this is, I am not going to disavoid. Fear of that I'm not going to be able to achieve what I want to achieve, the good, or not going to be able to avoid the evil I want to avoid. Daring, think of all the times in your life, maybe it could be something, I say, as simple, even though I know it's not simple, of asking somebody out on a date, and how that sometimes you have to work up your daring to do this. Right, that's the irascible. She's beautiful. She's attractive. I'm going to ask her out. Got to work up the irascible on this. And then finally, the one that sort of has no counterpart is anger. You know, when you think of an irascible, this is where the appetite takes its name from, the irascible. When you know, an irascible person is a person that's easily angered, that easily these emotions sort of flare up. And let's talk about the morality of them. For St. Thomas, I want to be clear on this. Emotions are morally neutral. They're neither good nor evil. They're only good or evil in reference to the command of reason or will, which is to say the command of your soul. Do they make you do things that are human or inhuman? Which is to say, do your emotions, your passions, make you do things that are rational or sub-rational? Do they make you act like an animal? If you're letting them make you act like an animal, then they're clearly evil. You've made them evil because you've allowed them to reduce your humanity. Passions are voluntary when they're commanded by the will, by our choice, or from not being checked by the will. The intellect and the will are the, we're going to get more into this in a minute, but the intellect and the will are the powers unique to the soul. It's that thought, that abstract thought, and the power of choice that makes us human. We all know there are times when we let our emotions get the better of us, where we know we need to stop thinking about this. We know we need to stop getting worked up about this. But secretly, we kind of like getting worked up about this. That's when you're not letting the emotions be checked. Sometimes we command the emotions. You know, you're sitting around, you know. Let's turn it away from something bad, like, you know, just sitting around and ruminating and holding on the grudge, you know, of your friend doing something that you didn't like, you know, and then how you sit around and you just sort of, oh, I'm gonna, you start stirring up memories, part of the body, gets the emotions running just so you can get angrier and angrier, oh, the next time I see him, you know. I mean, that's your command. You're doing it, and we all know we do it, right? But there's times when we can do that for the good. You know, I mean, for St. Thomas, the most obvious example is on the battlefield or in the case of life and death. I know I need to go into this burning building to, you know, to save this person. You got to work yourself up to it. That's your commanding your passions. And in fact, that makes your choice. That can make your choice even better because it was difficult and you needed the whole person to do it. It's important to say that for St. Thomas, the passions are not diseases or disturbances, except when they're not controlled by, except when we let them turn us into animals. He's all about us always operating in our highest human potential, with reason and making enlightened, reasonable choices for love, good, true love. Passions are the perfection of man. It's part of who we are because we're the composite. The Stoics argued that passions were evil because they were part of the body. Christians would never make that case. In fact, I'm going to tell you something. In his Summa Theologiae, where he handles 3,116 questions, he's talking about everything from God to the Trinity to creation to man to morality to Jesus Christ, the Church, the sacraments, the Blessed Mother. All of those topics, he spends more time on human passions than he does any other topic in the entire Summa. More time on human passions. Now, it's because he sees man as a rational animal. The two powers of the soul for St. Thomas are the intellect, your mind that's always pursuing for him the truth, which is another way of saying that is we are types of animals who are rational. We always want to know whatever it is. We don't have to be talking about like higher truths of philosophy and the humanities. The mechanic wants to know how the latest Model T, you know, Ford F-150 works. We always want to know. The moment you stop wanting to know anything, whether it's how to beat the next level on, you know, Fortnite or whatever it is, to learning, you know, for the sake of getting a diploma, to learning for the sake of knowing. The moment there's nothing you want to know anymore, that's usually the moment we start worrying about clinical depression. Right? We are creatures who want to know all the time. Everything. And the very fact that we all have different interests and different things we want to know for St. Thomas explains why we all have different types of lives. But we're all united in this way. We all want to know things, stuff we want to know. And the will for St. Thomas is always pursuing the good. I'm going to talk about what he means by the good in a second here. We might say that the will is a rational appetite. Unlike the irascible and the concupiscible appetites, which are sensitive appetites, you're sensitive, your body will flare up its emotions at the sight of a good pizza, at the sight of an attractive person, at the bodily's memory of a situation you experience later that day, of your imagination when you daydream and fantasize. Your bodily appetites will flare up. But the will is a rational appetite. Which means for St. Thomas, it always follows the intellect. It always does. The intellect has to identify true goods. And then the will says, yes, I want that good. Whether it's the true good of having a degree, whether it's the true good of this person I want in my life, whatever it is. And the intellect, of course, is not infallible. Sometimes the goods that the intellect proposes are not, in fact, true goods. Sometimes they're illusions. Sometimes they're temporary goods. Sometimes they're immediate goods for the sake of long-term goods. For St. Thomas, the good is that which is, these are all synonyms for St. Thomas, the good is that which is desirable. That which is desirable is that which actualizes a capacity or a potential. The very reason you might find a pizza good or desirable is because you have a deficiency of satiety. You're hungry. Right? There are certain pizzas I will never eat. If I am starving, I might even eat a pizza with pineapple on it. But only if I'm starving. Absolutely famished. Right? It becomes desirable. That's my intellect. This is the good. This is the only food around. You got to eat something, right? Now, in order to truly actualize, an agent must be truly perfect in act as regards to capacity. That's sort of philosophical lingo, which is simply to say, the simplest way to say it is that Jerry Maguire was right. You complete me, right? When you desire something, the reason it's, you see it as good is because it has something, it's actualized something that you yourself need. Whether that's food, a person in whom you see great goods that bring something to you in your life, or whether it's studying various topics and subjects. Right? And simply to be existing for St. Thomas, as in the Christian tradition, is already to be in a certain way already actualized. I'm already good by the mere fact that I exist. I'm not as good as I could be. I haven't fully actualized all my potencies, but I am already good in as much as I exist. And of course, for St. Thomas, God is goodness itself, truth itself, that we're all sort of pursuing. And God's goodness and truth is sort of manifest in this world, refracted, if you will, in existence, in a rainbow of ways, none of which, even taken together, equal his supreme goodness. Right? So every good and every true thing for St. Thomas that we experience in this world is a participation in the truth and goodness of God. Right. Which is what the intellect and will are actually looking for, which is why St. Augustine famously says, our hearts are restless until they rest in you. So we flit around this life looking for one good, one true thing after another, never satisfied that we have all the good we can have, all the true we can have, because we still don't have the true and the good, which is God. Now, for St. Thomas, This drive to good, to perfection, is what he calls love. Love is the drive to perfection. And it exists on all levels. The human level, the sensual level, the animal level, biological level. I would even say on the, atomic level. The drive of every being, every existing thing, to its own perfection, for St. Thomas, is what we call love. So the fact that geese fly south for the winter, St. Thomas would say, we can say in a certain sense that they love to fly. That's their goal. That's their purpose. The fact that electrons revolve around neutrons and protons. Electrons love to do this. All right, that's their nature. All things are created to have an aptitude to pursue their end, which is to say their goal, the very reason that they exist. And that's their love. Right? And there is a connaturality. There is a connaturality to things that are suitable, which other than you and I as human beings, because we have choice, everything else naturally loves and pursues its proper goal. The electron's natural aptitude is to revolve around protons and neutrons. So love is this principle of movement towards the end desired. So we can speak of a natural appetite, the natural love, things naturally seeking what is suitable to them according to their nature. That's true for all existing things. You, me, electrons, geese, dogs, trees, atoms, everything. We can speak of a sensitive appetite. These are the concupiscible and the irascible. This is what dogs and animals have. The moment they see and apprehend something as good, there's a necessity, they move to it. You can't blame the dog for not having the willpower not to eat the steak that you left perfectly cooked on the counter. The moment it apprehends it, unless you have significantly countermanded this apprehension with significant negative reinforcement, it's going to eat the steak. It doesn't have a choice in that matter. I don't believe in all those guilty dog videos. They're not guilty. They're not showing guilt. They're fearing because of their memories of what happened last time they did this, the negative reinforcement. But the rational appetite, which is what you and I have, arises from the apprehension of the good in the subject, which is you and me, by choice. The big thing about being human beings is that we can choose where we will find our goal, what we will love, what our end will be. Which also means we can actually choose to love things and to pursue things that are actually contrary to our nature, that are beneath us. That's what sin is for St. Thomas. Sin is loving something beneath you when you should love something equal to you and above you. Now, pursuing happiness for St. Thomas. This is our final point here. For St. Thomas, it requires what we might call speculative knowledge, which is to say, the thought of figuring out what happiness is and what it isn't. And everyone is going to have a different question on that, a different belief on that. St. Thomas is very clear on this. We all want happiness. Every human being is pursuing happiness. If you don't think you're pursuing happiness, there's no reason to get out of bed in the morning. Everything you do is one step that you have somehow, in your machinations, intellect and will, imagination, memory, realize that everything you do this morning will get you one step closer to being happy. Whether that's passing a class that you hate, so that you can get the degree, so that you can get the career, so that you can get the family, all of it is. Everything is about happiness. The very fact is, though, that not all of us are agreed on what perfect happiness is. Not all of us are agreed on what happiness in this life is. And we're also not agreed, even when we do agree on what perfect happiness is, we're not agreed on how to get to it. But we're all trying to figure it out. I always tell my students, for St. Thomas, morality is about two things, always about these two questions. What is happiness and how do I get it? That's for St. Thomas. Right? What is perfect happiness and how do I get it? Learning how to achieve happiness. And this requires action, putting knowledge to use in our choices. Once I sort of have a sense of what happiness is, whether it's giving my life over to God and family, or giving my life to my career, making the choices to achieve that. Right? Now, for St. Thomas, this is only possible. I'm just going to speed through these things quickly. This is only possible to do rightly when you are a person of virtue. Virtue for St. Thomas is what we might call a habitus. And I'm going to use habitus. It translates easily to habit, but we Thomists don't like to use the word habit because in English, habit has a lot of connotations that we don't want with this. We're going to use the Latin word habitus, which is both singular and plural, okay? So a habitus for St. Thomas is a quality or a character that relates, a typo there, a person to himself or herself in a mode of self-possession in relation to act. It means to be self-possessed when you make a choice. We all know when we're not virtuous and when we're not self-possessed. When you feel like you're just making choices, you're not thinking through them. When you're upset, your emotions are running wild, and you say the things that you know you shouldn't say, but you said it because you know it was going to be hurtful, and then the moment it comes out of your mouth, you wish you could take it back. Nah, that's not good character. Not good character there, right? So it's a character. And the reason we're the kind of beings that can develop these characters for St. Thomas is precisely because of that pursuit of the true and the good. there precisely isn't just one true thing and one good thing in this world. There's countless true things and countless good things. And your intellect, your will, and even your bodily appetite, your concupiscible and your irascible, can get sort of molded in pursuing certain true things and certain good things and not other true things and not other good things by making repeated choices of the same kind. Right? You get sort of disposed to continually to choose certain things that you have identified as good, whereas I'm disposed to choose other good things that I've identified as good. We could say that a habitus that is in line with our higher humanity, rationality, our virtues, but on the opposite end, if they go against our higher humanity, this is what we call vice. You know when you got a vice. Well, actually, generally, when you have a vice, you don't know you have a vice unless you're usually in complete denial about it. But when you see people who are vices, you can see how that they're trapped, but they've made so many vicious choices, right, that they're now sort of got a character that's the only kind of choices they can make, or that they can see themselves making. That's a habitus, right? That's a vicious habit. Classic example for college students would be, if you make it your life in college always to go out partying on Friday and Saturday nights, the weekend you need to stay in Friday and Saturday nights because you got to write a 25-page paper due on Monday, you're going to have a harder time doing this because you've developed the habitus, right? And so you're more easily disposed to go out Friday and Saturday night, right? And then, of course, we know the pattern. You sleep in, you're trying to cram it all in on Sunday. Yeah. Virtue, however, works the same way. The habitus are acquired through repeated choices of the same kind, although some can be infused by God's grace. We're not going to talk about that now. Just to simply say that vice enslaves us, virtue liberates us. Virtue for St. Thomas, because it's the more I choose to make reasonable choices in line with my higher good, my higher truths, the more I'm going to be disposed to make those kinds of choices in the future. I'm becoming a more virtuous person, right? Now, what does he describe as the virtuous person? The virtuous person is someone who knows the good or moral thing to do, does it in the right way, and takes delight in doing it. Those are three characteristics you need. Sometimes we know the right thing to do, the good thing to do, but we can't do it because we're scared, we're cowards, you know, we're afraid what's going to happen. So simply having the theory, the knowledge of what's the right thing to do is not enough to be virtuous. You actually have to do it. And simply doing it is often not enough to be perfect in virtue because you got to do it in the right way. Right? You all have roommates, right? I mean, I live in a house with 79 friars, 79 men, okay? You learn very quickly that if I got a problem with Father, you know, Bruno, all right, because Father Bruno, you know, always leaves a mess at the table after breakfast. Always. I know I need to say something to Father Bruno, but knowing when to say it to Father Bruno, and how to say it to Father Bruno, at what point, probably not while he's running to class. So that's the virtuous person. The virtuous person knows the right thing to do and how to do it in the right way at the right time. And takes delight in it. Takes delight in it. If you're doing the right thing at the right time, the right way, but you're kind of grumbling about it, you kind of wish you didn't have to do it, not yet virtuous. The virtuous person has passions rightly ordered to the higher good or the higher loves and higher reason. And the virtuous person is not a stoic, because the virtuous person has a certain self-mastery. St. Thomas, the virtuous person, is someone who is not a person who doesn't feel things. On the contrary, the virtuous person is someone who feels more deeply than probably you and I do. I'm presuming not everyone here has achieved perfect virtue. The virtuous person feels very deeply and very strongly the passions, because the virtuous person isn't scared by the passions, isn't scared that he or she is going to be dragged away by them. So they're free to actually experience them for what they are, and the goodness that they are, and the goodness the body is. How do we become virtuous? Just a few points here. It is the point of the moral life for St. Thomas to become virtuous. I'd simply say learning from elders and community customs normally, unless you have a community that simply is not virtuous and is more vicious than virtuous. Learning from elders. Aristotle, when he talks about moral philosophy in the Nicomachean Ethics, said that young people should never study moral philosophy because they haven't lived life long enough. I mean, the honest truth is you got to live life. You have to live the moral life a long time and make a whole lot of mistakes. You become virtuous by making mistakes of virtue, right? And being reflective. Next time I talk to Father Bruno, I should probably not raise my voice. You know, this will go over better that way, right? Being reflective about it, and being educated, and taking counsel from people. I'm sure we all sort of know people that we think to ourselves sometimes, maybe it's your parents, maybe it's grandparents, who you can't get access to at the moment, but you might think, what would he or she do in this situation? You try to play out if you were talking to them what they might say. That's all using imagination and memory to become a virtuous person. And then I always like to tell my students, when it comes to virtue, you just got to fake it sometimes. Figure out what a prudent person will do, what a chaste person would do, what a courageous person would do, what a just person, and do that, even if you're not yet chaste, courageous, temperate, all of that. You do that enough, that's how you become virtue. So you fake it, and then you'll get it. Right? The reason this is so hard, this is the last two slides, the reason this is so hard is frankly because of original sin. The human person is no longer naturally obedient to God. Remember my triangle? So everything sort of falls. The chain falls. The links fall. So the intellect is darkened. The will is weakened. And the passions are inflamed. The body is at war with the soul. The body no longer sort of obeys the soul as much as it should, as much as it's designed to. But there's good news in all of this, and that is the grace of Jesus Christ is at work in all believers to slowly heal the defects of the soul. Though in this life, and this comes from St. Paul, who's always focused on the mind and the soul and grace, this grace does not work in the body of our composite. All right, this is why even if you're the most holy person in the world, you still have to deal with arthritis and growing old and your body warring against the flesh or the spirit. This is why even the most holiest person, the most virtuous person, can probably stay up for 10 hours praying. I don't know any such people. But will eventually collapse in exhaustion. Right? The body cannot keep up with the graced soul, the body in this life. That's why the resurrected body is much better. All right. So grace enlightens the mind with faith, infuses the will with hope and charity, which is the supreme love that measures everything. The struggles with the body and the soul remain. And that goes across the board, not only when you're young and have to deal with bodily hormones and everything else and bodily passions, it remains even as you get old and you get more and more sense that your body is not really doing what you wish it would do. Right? But we go through this not without the aid of grace. And then at the resurrection of the body, the graces of the soul overflow into the glorified body, and the glorified body is then able, finally, to keep up with the soul in our sort of glory of God. Thank you.